Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.
The news doesn't stop between Morning Edition and All Things Considered. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson, co-hosts for Here and Now,
your source for comprehensive news, information, and interviews in the middle of your day.
We're combining the resources of NPR and WBUR Boston to bring you stories that will keep you up to date.
Entertain you with features and music.
Join us Here and Now.
Listen Monday through Thursday from 11 to 1 p.m. on Valley Public Radio.
From Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition, FM89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, we'll talk with Diego Luna, the acclaimed filmmaker. His new movie, titled Cesar Chavez, comes out in theaters nationwide later this month. We'll find out why it's taken Hollywood so long to do a motion picture about the life of the late farm labor leader. We'll also talk about Chavez's legacy and about the cast of the film, which includes America Ferrera, Rosario Dawson, and John Malkovich. Later in the hour, we'll be joined by Bakersfield-based author Nick Balardes, who's penned a somewhat controversial essay online in response to a recent study by a Connecticut university that ranked Bakersfield as, quote, the least literate city in America, with Fresno not very far behind. Balardes actually agrees with the study and says the Valley at times helps foster a climate of anti-intellectualism. We'll talk about that and some of the implications of that study, and more importantly, what can we do to try to turn that trend around and foster things like literacy and educational attainment here in Central California. But first, our ongoing series, Voices of the Drought, continues. So far, we've talked to farmers, we've talked to nurserymen, cities, landscapers, the list goes on and on. But today we turn to wildlife and the impact to our natural ecosystem here in the central San Joaquin Valley. You've heard a lot about the impact to the Delta ecosystem, the Delta smelt and salmon, but the drought has a much broader impact here in Central California. But as FM89's Ezra David Romero found out, it's not just the lack of water that has local fish hatchery workers concerned, it's the temperature.
There are over 1.5 million fish at the San Joaquin Fish Hatchery at the base of Friant Dam, which holds back Millerton Lake on the border of Fresno and Madera counties. Greg Pape runs a hatchery for the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. Today, he's inspecting the health of rainbow trout that he and his team have watched grow from eggs to 4 to 6 pounders.
Ah, come on. Okay, there you can see the rainbow stripe on him. He's probably going to flop real soon. If he was all by himself in here, he'd be a lot, whoop, there he goes, a lot silverier.
This hatchery, along with three others in the region, are dependent on snow melt collected in the state's reservoirs, like Millerton Lake. And the lack of snow has officials like Dean Marston concerned, not just with the amount of water, but also its temperature. He's an environmental program manager with CDFW, who oversees 12 California counties. He says water temperatures are good at the moment.
But as we progress later into the spring and temperatures start to warm, flows start to reduce, then we might have to rethink how we're raising fish in our hatcheries and rethink where we're planting the fish.
The hatchery at the base of Friant Dam uses water pulled from the reservoir to regulate the temperature of 6 acres of fish runs and ponds. Pape and I took a walk to feed a run of more than 1,000 mid-sized rainbow trout.
We don't have any chillers or anything like that. We can control the temperature to a good extent up at the dam. There's a valve up high in the Frank Kern Canal. There's a valve down low at the bottom of the dam. And it's essentially as easy as adjusting your shower temperature. You open one valve, close the rest, and you can adjust your temperature higher or lower.
Pape's major concern is that if reservoir levels become too low at Friant Dam, Millerton Lake water will become warmer, making it harder for fish to take in oxygen.
We've never experienced a one-year drought this drastic. We've had 2- and 3-year droughts that each year was built on the one before, but this is the lowest water year since, anyone can remember around here.
So basically, if the snowpack doesn't become denser in a jiffy, a parade of trout and salmon could be relocated to cooler waters around the state instead of released in the valley creeks, lakes, and rivers. The San Joaquin Hatchery releases just shy of 1 million catchable-sized fish a year into waters that flow into the San Joaquin Valley. Here's Greg Kohlenborn, who oversees the 4 hatcheries in Central California.
But we'll get through it.
We have, you know, certain numbers and pounds of fish allotted for every water annually. And then that's more of a kind of a game plan of what we're going to do for the year. And as conditions change, we just alter those slightly to accommodate the conditions of the individual year.
But a warmer year isn't always a bad thing, according to these fish growers. Once again, Greg Pape.
The fish grow faster as the temperature gets warmer up to a certain point. And once you reach that magic midway point, then their growth slows down because the oxygen is lower in the water. But there's that happy medium where the growth is good, the oxygen content is good, and they do real well.
And that's something that both fishermen and fish hatcheries will be monitoring closely as winter turns to spring in Central California. Reporting from the San Joaquin Fish Hatchery at Friant Dam, I'm Ezra David Romero.
You're listening to Valley Edition. The area around Los Banos isn't just a stopover for valley travelers along Highway 152 headed to the Central Coast. It's also a vital rest stop for millions of birds from across North America along the Pacific Flyway.
If you come out here and you really don't see it off of any of the major highways, but you know, here we have something that definitely is, at least from an ecological perspective, equivalent to Yosemite Valley.
That's Rick Ortega, the general manager of the Grasslands Water District in Los Banos. His agency is charged with distributing water for a massive collection of state and federal wildlife reserves and privately owned duck hunting clubs. Together, they cover over 200,000 acres from around Dos Palos to Gustin.
That's equivalent of about the size of New York City, 300 square miles. So this is the largest contiguous wetland in the western United States.
The Grasslands Ecological Area is a vital habitat for millions of shorebirds, waterfowl, and other species. Of the 5 to 6 million birds that migrate over the Pacific Flyway, over half spend their winters in the valley, with over 1 million in the grasslands alone. So what brings all these birds to Central California? One thing, water. And in this year of severe drought, that's what has everyone from biologists to duck hunters concerned, a possible devastating year for migratory birds and other species.
Across the board, there's going to be some severe impacts. We're working with resource managers throughout the state to ensure that we're staging adequate water, or just maximizing our footprint to minimize another ecological disaster.
Final water allocations have yet to be announced, but Ortega says the district expects to receive about 30% of its normal supply from the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation. That's more than some valley farmers can expect to receive, but it won't be enough to keep many of these birds alive and healthy. But as Ortega and I go for a hike on the state-run Los Banos Wildlife Area, right now, things look surprisingly normal. Just beyond the tall reeds lies a shallow lake filled with hundreds of birds, ranging from mallards to majestic sandhill cranes. And on this rare clear day, you can see the snow-capped peaks of the Sierra Nevada off in the distance as several white egrets fly by.
The water that we see here is the remnants of last year's water. The birds that we're seeing here are mallards and gadwall. These are our local breeding birds at this point. So you'll see quite a few of them are paired up.
The real concern here is what will happen later in 2014 and early next year. Normally, these ponds would be irrigated in the summer to help native grasses grow and provide seed for birds and habitat for their other favorite food, insects. Then, early in the fall, the land would be flooded, just in time for birds migrating south from Canada. But this year, with only 50,000 acre-feet of water spread out over a massive area, the consequences for wildlife could be huge.
The reality is that these birds are going to arrive in droves, and so there will be immense overcrowding. We'll exhaust our food base very quickly, so these birds will be of poor body condition, they'll be emaciated, and the overcrowding is the precursor to disease outbreaks like cholera and botulism. So we could see massive die-offs in a year like this.
While the ultimate scope of the problem is still uncertain, officials are looking to past droughts and die-offs for clues. Steve Brugman, an environmental scientist with the California Department of Fish and Wildlife's Mendota Wildlife Area, says to make matters worse, this year may have an especially large population of birds from Canada.
The prairie regions and other regions to the north have been getting plenty of water. They're going to have good habitat to produce birds. So you may have a lot of birds come down next winter to the south, to our areas, and not find a lot of wetlands. So it'll concentrate those birds. And then the possibility of having some disease like cholera increases.
He says the situation this year is simply unprecedented.
We've never had a cutback like this since I've been here, and I've been here since the mid-1980s.
And birds aren't the only concern. With little possibility of maintaining year-round water at the Volta Wildlife Refuge, Ortega says there's a very real concern that some endangered species could be at risk of survival.
We also have the only reproductive population south of the delta of the giant garter snake, which we are very concerned we may lose this summer.
Of course, droughts are nothing new in the Golden State, and some research suggests that California's historical climate might be more like this year than what we've known for the last century. But urban and agricultural development has claimed around 95% of the valley's former wetlands, including the ancient Tulare Lake. And that's why these public and private wetlands play a critical role in the ecosystem of not just the valley, but all of Western North America.
You know, these aren't our birds. They're California's and they're, you know, the United States and Canada and Mexico. They move through us and they're dependent on all of the habitat.
Water managers hope to have a better idea of their allocations later this month. Reporting from Los Banos, for Valley Edition, I'm Joe Moore. You can see photos from the San Joaquin River Fish Hatchery and the Grasslands Water District on our website at kvpr.org. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment and talk to acclaimed filmmaker Diego Luna about his new movie about the life of Cesar Chavez. It's coming up here on Valley Edition.
Another fabulous Valley Public Radio wine tasting event is coming up, again on the first Sunday in May. Hi, this is Christina Herrick, looking forward to seeing you by the river at the beautiful Lester Estate in Fresno for a memorable afternoon, sampling great wines, making new friends, and shopping in our silent auction. Yummy food, too. Wine tasting tickets are available by calling 800-275-0764 or order online at kvpr.org.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Later this month, the story of the late farm labor leader Cesar Chavez hits the silver screen with a biopic by acclaimed director Diego Luna. It's the first time a major motion picture has been made about the life of the founder of the United Farm Workers Union. It features a cast of Hollywood stars including America Ferrera, Rosario Dawson, and John Malkovich, with Michael Peña cast as the late civil rights hero. Tomorrow night, President Obama will host a screening of the film at the White House. It opens nationwide next Friday, March 28th, and the UFW Foundation plans to host special fundraiser screenings in Bakersfield on March 29th and in Fresno on March 30th. Director Diego Luna joins us now on our program. Diego, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
Are you surprised that it's taken this long for someone to make a film about the life of Cesar Chavez?
I was shocked. Yeah. When we opened our office here in L.A. and we were looking for stories and what was our next film, and we realized that there was no film about Cesar Chavez. We were shocked. We were a little irritated, I have to say, because this is a country and an industry that celebrates every heroic story in cinema, you know, and our community hasn't been celebrated. And definitely we wanted to change that.
Here in Central California, many of us are very familiar with the story of Cesar Chavez's life and his organization of the United Farm Workers Union. But there's a generation, or maybe even two generations of people, young people, who maybe know the name Cesar Chavez but don't know his story or what he did. Do you think your movie can help to bring new context to just the important role that he played?
Yeah, I really hope so, you know. I think I am, in a way, part of that generation, in fact. I arrived to California, and not when we opened the company, but years ago, with my work after Itumama Tambien, I had to come a lot to the States. And I knew there was someone called Cesar Chavez that did something, but I wasn't really aware of what it meant or how important it was, you know, and the message that they sent. I found myself many times driving through an avenue called Cesar Chavez, looking at a mural in East LA of Cesar Chavez, but not actually knowing, who he was and what was behind his story. And I think through the film and through the whole research, I started to find out how important it is to tell this story, because it is a story that can inspire young people, not just Latinos, but young people in this country, that change is in our hands, that if change happens, is because we get involved. And stories like this one can bring a reflection that today is needed. We've been showing the film to young audiences, people in high schools and colleges, and the reaction is amazing, you know. In a way, many times we forget that by looking back and finding out where we come from, we can understand who we are better, you know. We tend just to try to reinvent the world always and always, but there's great examples on our past of how to do things, you know. And these people send a beautiful message, a message of change, of a nonviolent movement, of ideas as a main tool of change, you know? And I think that's very pertinent today.
As much as you focus on Cesar Chavez, the civil rights hero, you also focus in the movie about Cesar Chavez, the man, the father, the husband. Tell me about how you went about approaching treating him on the screen and what you saw in Michael Peña's performance.
I don't think film can be a history lesson. I think film should be an experience, an emotional experience that connects with everyone, you know. And I love film when film is universal, when it can hit someone that knows the context and the specificity of the context, but also to those who don't have an idea or a connection with it. To me, the film becomes strong when you say, well, yes, it is about the farm worker movement. It is about the fight in the fields back then. But at the end, it's just about a father and a son, you know. It's about the big sacrifice a father has to do to bring something better to the life of his children, you know. And that process of us as sons, as kids, many times not understanding this, you know. And I felt, well, the chance to find drama on this story is there. You know, and a universal drama that can hit anyone. And the thing about working with Michael is that I thought he was not just an amazing actor, but the best one to play this, because his experience is very close to Cesar's. He's a first generation. He was born in Chicago, but his father came and crossed the border from Purificación, Jalisco. He understands this feeling of this duality, you know, of being a first generation, of being in school and having to learn in English, but go back home and have Spanish as the main way to communicate with your parents. That come from a place that you just hear stories, but you're not allowed to go, because there's a fear of not being able to come back, you know. Anyway, I thought he was the right actor. He understands the Mexican-American experience pretty well.
the rest of your cast did a fine job in the film. Rosario Dawson as Dolores Huerta, America Ferrera as well. Tell me about the performances and just working with these great actors in this film and what you think they brought to their characters in this biography.
Well, in a way, the two actresses you just mentioned are really close to their characters, you know? They're like, they're activists. They're very loud about what they believe in. When I sat down with Rosario for half hour the first time and I wanted to tell her about the project and get to know her a little bit, she almost convinced me to sign for Voto Latino in that moment, you know? And I realized I was in front of an organizer and that she was perfectly right for the character, you know? She had a little Dolores inside, you know? So that happened to me with many of them. Also, all these actors, they understand the importance and the necessity of stories like this to be out. You know, they live in an industry that gives them just a little, just very little options. You know, and many times the characters that represent our community in this country they fall into the stereotype. They're very limited, and by sending the message to this country that our stories need to be out, their lives are also going to change. And you could tell they knew how important it was to celebrate our heroes and to be part of this. As a director, I've never had so much interest in actors of coming and audition, you know. Normally, you have to convince actors to come and audition for you. This time we were receiving calls, you know. Everyone wanted to be part of this because it matters, because it's time, and they wanted to join.
You mentioned the limited number of roles for Hispanic actors and actresses in Hollywood, and is that something that you hope to be able to be a part of that change? I understand it was challenging at first getting the financing to do this film, but then things picked up. I'd be curious to hear your comments on the role of Latinos in Hollywood today and what you think could be done to improve that.
Well, I mean, I don't know, but tell me, who was the Latino presenting at the Oscars? There was none, you know?
Exactly.
The closest we got was Penelope Cruz that comes from Spain. I think this needs to change, obviously. I think this industry has to celebrate this community and has to understand that there is an audience that wants to be represented, you know? And things are changing very fast. And the community is becoming more and more complex, you know. Now there's a fourth, fifth generation. It's changing. And I'm talking about the ones making film. We have to understand that this is the moment to react and portray the stories and celebrate their heroes, our heroes, you know.
Obviously, so many of the issues that this film deals with are still with us today. What do you think that Cesar Chavez would say about our current situation with the broken immigration system and the great challenges that this country faces in trying to move forward? What do you think he would say today if he were alive and with us?
I think he would be trying hard to organize as many people as he could in order to send a message. You cannot say you live in the land of freedom where more than 11 million people are working, feeding, building this country, you know, making sure America is what it is, and they're not recognized, you know. They're not recognized, respected, and celebrated, and that needs to change, you know. It's just unfair that those who are picking our food can barely feed their families, you know.
One last question for you. Was it challenging to focus on one particular portion of Cesar Chavez's life? The film is really set in about 10 years surrounding the great boycott in Delano in the 1960s. How did you choose that, and what was that process like in finding one area to focus on in this man's amazing story?
Well, I've always thought that it's very unfair when you're telling a story that it happened
to pretend to tell the story of someone's life in an hour and 45 minutes, you know. In fact, it's already unfair to tell 10 years of the story of someone in an hour and 45 minutes. But at least my goal was to use the boycott as the main message behind this film, you know. Because, yes, the film is about Cesar Chavez, but there's something behind and more important, that Cesar wouldn't be Cesar Chavez if it wasn't for everyone around him. And Cesar wouldn't be Cesar Chavez if this country wouldn't have reacted to the call of farm workers back then, you know. So it's about us consumers, you know. It's about the responsibility of being a citizen. And I think today we need to remember that. We need to be reminded of that. The power of being a citizen, you know, it comes with a responsibility. But if we find a way to connect with others, as Cesar Chavez said, our strength is in our numbers, you know. And I believe today there's so many in the need of change, and there's so many also that believe in change. We just have to organize. We just have to learn how to be heard. And, yeah, that was the idea, and that's why I chose those 10 years, you know. And also, again, because I wanted to do a film that could engage with an audience anywhere, not just those who today care about the issues of farm workers, you know.
Our guest today has been director Diego Luna. His new film, Cesar Chavez, it debuts later this month. Diego Luna, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for giving me the chance to talk about this film, and hopefully we'll get to fill those cinemas on the 28th and send the message that our stories need to be portrayed in cinema.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Cities like Merced, Fresno, and Bakersfield all share one common threat. Other than being major stops on Highway 99, they all routinely rank at the bottom of various lists published by national publications ranking the nation's cities on everything from access to public parks to air quality to things like drunkenness. While the validity of some of these lists may be dubious at best, they do raise many interesting questions about our region, its challenges, and how to make the Valley a better place to live. Last month, Time magazine reported on a study from Central Connecticut State University that examined the nation's most literate and least literate cities. They analyzed data on everything from public libraries to newspaper circulation and ranked Bakersfield dead last, with Fresno not far behind. So what's behind the numbers, and what should we do to turn it around? Joining us now is Bakersfield-based author Nick Bilardis, who has written a response to the study, which has generated a lot of discussion online in the past few weeks. Nick, welcome to our program.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
This study that came out from the Central Connecticut State University looked at a number of things. It ranked Bakersfield as the nation's least literate city. What was your initial reaction when you read that news?
Well, I wasn't surprised because this has been going on for several years in a row. I don't know how long they've been doing the study, but generally the last 3 or 4 years, Bakersfield's been getting ranked really low. So I'd even covered this type of story on a more newsy kind of format before, so I wasn't too surprised. But what I did think was, oh, man, Russo's Books just closed, one of the last independent bookstores in Bakersfield. Although they're an online entity, their physical bookstore closed. So I thought, wow, what's going to happen when the study finds out about that?
So you wrote about this on a website, theweakling.com, and you wrote an essay that takes an interesting perspective about this. What prompted you to write that essay, and what did you hope to bring across with that?
Well, you know, I've been asked by a few different people to write an essay, and it wasn't until Greg Ulliar, and it wasn't until he asked me that I really got interested in writing a piece. And I knew that if I wrote something, that it wouldn't be a happy piece, because at the time I'd been reading, once again, Richard Hofstadter's book on anti-intellectualism in American life. And so, you know, just it was sort of a perfect storm to kind of lash out and in my complaint against what might be going on as not part of just a Valley problem, but maybe it's a national problem, this whole trend of illiteracy that's going on. So I thought, well, you know, I have some beefs, and I'm not working for local media of any kind at the time, although I have. And so I didn't feel like I had to answer to anybody except my own conscience. And so I wrote the piece.
You asked some interesting questions here in talking about this climate of anti-intellectualism, as you call it. You talk about the situation at CSUB. You say at the University in Bakersfield, if you aren't playing baseball, then you might be getting a business degree, which fuels many students these days to enroll there. Maybe it's just a reflection of culture, the notion of Bakersfield having a prominent business school where many have become successful business people. But you talk about the fact that other programs at the university aren't as well known or have the same prestige. You talk about the attitudes against pursuing a life in the letters, so to speak. This is something, as you just said, is maybe a national issue, but why do you think it's such an issue, in your view, here in the Valley?
Well, definitely it's an issue in the Valley because I know more of what's happening in at least the South Valley. I know that there's, you know, you can't take a creative writing course every semester at Bakersfield College or CSU Bakersfield anymore. I don't think you ever could every semester at CSUB, where Fresno State has a wonderful MFA program. CSUB doesn't have that sort of thing. And so I've just seen some of the humanities and hearing from professors, because I know so many professors in Fresno and Bakersfield, and one of the main complaints is the humanities are shrinking. It's hard to get full-time job, even adjunct jobs teaching things like English are disappearing. It's getting even more competitive to get these jobs. So that kind of knowledge really affects me as a writer, as somebody who's taught history before at Bakersfield College, and I've taught a lot of writing. So those kinds of things just really affect me and affect my perspective about, well, what's happening in the Southern Central Valley.
These are certainly regional issues, and that's one thing that I've seen people bring up on your blog and on Facebook on the post on theweaklings.com. They bring up the fact that this part of California is home to immigrant communities from across the globe that come here for work. Is it just a factor of our economy here that we have this immigrant base that makes up a large portion of our communities? Do you think that's the issue?
I don't even think that's the main issue because, you know, I don't look at immigrants as being the main problem here. I don't look at a kid who speaks Spanish as being illiterate because they're still speaking the language, right? They're still speaking Spanish. I look at it as a larger problem. I remember, I think it was about 2 years ago, that a big stink came up because in the CSU system, within the CSU system, they were trying to eradicate the Romance languages from CSU Bakersfield. Here we have a community that has a lot of Spanish-speaking people, and people who want to take Spanish as not just an elective, but as maybe their course in life. You know, there's so many avenues you could explore by having Spanish as the major. And here we have the Spanish as a language on the university campus nearly eradicated. I remember attending one of those meetings at CSU campus. It was sort of a press conference that was going on. And I find that's despicable. I mean, I don't look at that as a problem with the Spanish-speaking people. I look at that as a problem. There's a different problem going on. I look at a lot of Spanish-speaking peoples as they're getting educated. They're becoming our teachers. They're becoming doctors and nurses and intellectuals and academics.
Again, if you just joined us on Valley Edition today, we're talking with Bakersfield-based author Nick Belardis, who has a post on a website called theweaklings.com that is a response to a recent study released by Central Connecticut State University. Bakersfield, the least literate city in America. Fresno was not all that far behind in this analysis of everything from public library data to newspaper circulation to the number of bookstores in communities. And Nick talks in his post a lot about a climate that he calls a climate of anti-intellectualism. Time magazine pointed out something interesting in their analysis of this data and looking at the bottom five cities and throwing in Fresno, which was just outside of the bottom five. They said San Antonio, Bakersfield, Corpus Christi, these communities that are at the bottom all have the lowest levels of professional employment in the nation, white-collar jobs, corporate America jobs, those sorts of things. Do you think that has something to do with it? Because that's one of the things that Time magazine was pointing out, that we don't have the type of employment here that requires the maybe advanced degrees and higher levels of education that you would have in maybe Silicon Valley or in Southern California or other places like that.
Oh, I think that's definitely part of the problem. I mean, I've seen articles out of Fresno about the brain drain, where our smartest and brightest, they leave and then they don't come back. And why is that? Well, I think a lot of it is the jobs aren't there. I think there is also another problem is that people who leave and they're woeful about their own area. They don't find value in it, which I do. I actually do find a great value in the Central Valley. I've written much of my literature and poetry has been about the Central Valley, and while it's full of conflict, I find the area rich, extremely rich, and so that's why I've lived in Bakersfield on and off for so many years. I think the job market and what you mentioned earlier about the economy in general, which in turn affects the job market, you know, I think that as well as people just being young kids saying, oh, there's nothing to do in the Central Valley, there's nothing to do in Fresno, there's nothing to do in Bakersfield, when you and I both know you could go out every night of the week in Fresno or Bakersfield and either go to at least in Fresno, go to a poetry reading, or in Bakersfield, there's always theater going on. In Bakersfield, it's super rich in theater. There's always something going on. But when these kids leave and they don't come back, it hurts us. So what can we do to create more jobs? Well, that's a big question, right?
The natural response in many communities when these sorts of lists come out, there are folks who immediately become very defensive and trot out evidence to the contrary. And certainly there is a great deal of evidence to the contrary in something like this. We can cite a number of great cultural institutions and the fine work that the folks do at the Kern County Public Library, the faculty and students at CSUB and Bakersfield College and throughout the Central Valley, who do such great things. But do you think that's just a part of a natural response? Why not take a stance and say this is why this is wrong?
Well, I think people get really defensive, you know, and I think that's why an article like this is really dangerous. I don't think I would have been allowed to write this type of article had I worked for a local TV station or a radio station. I was attacked on a Bakersfield radio station just a couple of days ago. In fact, the shock jock tried to discredit me by saying he called CSUB saying the history department wasn't shrinking. But at the same time, you know, that happens when more than one person talks to different sources. But I'm a product of the graduate program at CSUB. I would suggest that I'm able to dig in a little bit deeper. But at the same time, you know, I rail a little bit against who our celebrities are, at least in the South Valley. I don't think people here are aware who their cultural heroes might be.
Reading again from your piece, and you're describing Bakersfield here. Here, weather girls, conservative shock jocks, and TV anchormen are its biggest celebrities, where used-up newscasters get recycled, lending what's left of their hard-earned celebrity-dom to cheesy television commercials promoting local businesses and lawyers. And I want to read one other part here, talking about Bakersfield, describing the city as having its strip mall appeal is the equivalent of fruit rotting on the ground with its non-intellectual celebrities, boarded up businesses and historical buildings transformed to rubble in a cityscape of boxy structures, all bereft of splendor and detail. You paint a very bleak picture of the city, of the South Valley. How to change that? What's the proactive approach here? What do you suggest we do to try to improve our city?
Well, as the little guy, because I'm a little guy, is I mentioned at the end of the article, which is a dream to build a coffee house bookstore, you know, create something that can build community and then you rally the troops around it. I try to hold a lot of literary readings around town. I also just did the Invisible Memoirs project, which I know was held in Fresno as well through Memoir Journal, and many students were published in the in their anthologies, the Invisible Memoir project. So it's doing things of value to the community that could sort of change what this particular study is reporting on. If it's saying there aren't enough bookstores, then let's build some more bookstores. You know, if it needs more magazines, build more magazines. If it needs more people to have subscriptions to scholarly journals, then we need more academics in the city. Then what can we do to boost our universities and to boost their junior colleges so that they get more enrollment? You know, I don't know the answers to how to get more enrollment other than better marketing from the those types of institutions and more community support from the top as well. What are the institutions that make the most money and who could contribute to those institutions and not just in a way to sport that goes to sports programs? And don't get me wrong, because I'm a big sports junkie too. And I went to a lot of CSUB baseball games last summer. I'm a huge sports junkie. So I don't hate sports. I just think that there's a way that more money could possibly funnel in through, if Bakersfield's so rich in agribusiness and oil, well, why isn't some of that money, or maybe some of it is, why isn't enough of that money going into expansion and attracting people to these academic types of lifestyles? And it may have to come from the bottom. It may have to come from people like me who write these kinds of articles and who follow through with dreams.
Well, it's certainly an interesting article and a thought-provoking one. You can find a link to it on our website. It's called Postcard from the Most Illiterate City in America. It's by Bakersfield-based author Nick Bilardis, who joins us on Valley Edition today. It's a response to a recent study from Central Connecticut State University about literacy levels throughout the country. Nick Bilardis, thank you so much for joining us on Valley Edition.
Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure.
Listening to Valley Edition. Deep beneath the streets of One Valley City lies a hidden world, unknown to most, forgotten by many. Yet some still have vivid memories of these underground passages, and our next guest is doing his best to bring the stories of Bakersfield's underground tunnels to life. Richard Bean is the president and CEO of the Bakersfield Californian. He's been writing about these tunnels in his Bakersfield Observed column, and Richard joins us on the program today. Richard, welcome.
Thank you, sir.
Bakersfield's tunnels, this comes as a surprise to many people, but longtime residents have some fond memories of these subterranean passageways in older parts of town. How did the story start to develop?
But that's a good question, Joe. Actually, I did not discover this. The tunnels underneath Bakersfield have been well documented for years. They are certainly well known to the older members of the community. But, you know, like a lot of Valley cities, we have folks moving in here, particularly with the oil boom, who really know very little about kind of Bakersfield in the 20s and 30s and 40s, and then, of course, during the 52 earthquake. So there's been a really surprisingly and sometimes funny level of interest in this story. I got onto this story because somebody had the column I write, for those who don't read it, is really short takes and memories and about old Bakersfield or concerns around town. It's not really a political column. It's not deep journalism. It's just kind of a slice of life. And somebody had mentioned the tunnels, and it just sparked a deluge of memories of these things. And so that's how it started. One person mentioned it, and literally my mailbox filled up over the last few weeks with memories of it.
Now, there are a lot of cities in the West that are known for their underground historic neighborhoods. Seattle comes to mind. Even Sacramento has some underground resources. Fresno's Chinatown also has some tunnels. Tell me about these tunnels in Bakersfield and what you're hearing from some of your readers and writing in and their stories. Exactly what sorts of passages are we talking about here?
Yeah, it's interesting, and maybe some folks say tunnels is maybe a misnomer. A lot of these are very extensive basements that were connected by, you know, through tunnels under the street. But I don't think it's incorrect to call them tunnels. And most of the interest or most of the legend around Bakersfield tunnels centers on what was an old Chinatown in Bakersfield on the east side of town. Bakersfield in around Prohibition had a very, very large Chinese community, and a lot of the architecture on the east side of town will reflect that. East Bakersfield now, the town has really grown to the west, so it's part of the older downtown that's largely forgotten or unknown by a lot of the folks who move into the suburbs on the west side. But the stories surround during Prohibition that there were the Chinese community, a lot of them, you know, a lot of these tunnels were built because, as you know, our heat in the summer, the valley heat is just excruciating, so folks would sleep down there. But the Chinese were very resourceful folk, and so there were opium dens down there. You could gamble down there, you could eat down there, and you can drink down there. And a lot of our older readers will remember, one of them wrote to me that was pretty funny and said that as a child, you could make extra money hanging around Chinatown because wives would come look for their husbands and pay you a nickel to go into the tunnels to find your husband if he was down there gambling.
Oh, my goodness. Very interesting. To what degree do these tunnels still exist today?
Well, I'm kind of a history buff, and it's fascinating to me because they've never been documented. You know, some of them apparently collapsed in the great earthquake of 52. There were two really tremendous earthquakes in 52 that changed Bakersfield forever. If you look at the historical photos, mm-hmm. this was once a town of Victorian hotels and beautiful old buildings.
Yeah, the old
and in
52, house, yeah.
most of those went down, and now old downtown was built in kind of the sterile East Berlin style of the 50s, you know. And some of the tunnels collapsed then, but a lot of them did exist. You can go anywhere downtown, and anybody has a basement, and most of them have been boarded up, either boarded up or they would bricked up. But you will see archways that lead into them. It is interesting to me that nobody has really documented where they are. I thought it would be a good kind of project for an architecture school or a class out at Cal State or something like that. But people, you know, they vividly remember, the older readers, where they were. You know, there was one at the old Kern County Land Building and across the streets that Tegler Hotel, both buildings which still stand, and apparently people used to work in the land building, and when it was hot, they would use the tunnel to go to the restaurant in the Tegler. People, you know, remember these things well. But as far as I know, other than individual property owners who know that there's tunnels there and people who remember walking through them, there is no central documented place of what connects them.
Does the Californian, its historic building, have any tunnels that you know of?
No, unfortunately, we don't.
I had to
ask. This building was built in 1926, and it's got
it's new.
of history itself. But I'd love to have some tunnels, but we don't.
Very, very interesting as well. If you just joined us on Valley Edition, we're talking to Richard Bean. He's the president and CEO of the Bakersfield Californian. And if you've caught his Bakersfield Observe column in the last few weeks in the paper and online, you've probably seen readers writing in talking about their memories of Bakersfield's historic tunnels or interconnected basements in Chinatown and in downtown. You really do a great job with your column, not just with this topic, but bringing back some of those memories that people have of the community, whether it's talking about the Green Frog Market or the tunnels or any of these things. There's this sense of nostalgia that so many of us have in our Valley communities that have changed so much over the years. Do you see that as growing today with our modern world of text messaging and apps and everything people are longing for these days gone by?
Yeah, I think that's a universal truth. I'm from Atlanta, and when I go back, the city has changed so much over the years. But I think we all long for the days when life was simpler, and growing up was just you think of modern society and all the problems we have. And these tunnels, I think, are a metaphor for that. That it was. I mean, I had a 92-year-old man on. We do a simulcast radio video show, and he was on my program. He was remembering the tunnels, and he was saying back then there was no crime. I mean, he remembered every brothel in town. Brothels were illegal.
There was no crime though.
He remembers the tunnels where he had a Chinese friend who he was like 10 years old who took him down. He smelled the opium, and it was, he said, it was just a safe community. But he could name exactly where this man's memory was amazing, every tunnel was, every brothel was. He knew the name of the bartenders at the old Southern Hotel. I mean, it was incredible, and that sparked another wave of people just remembering these things. Apparently, I had one reader write in who said down around where our old Chinatown was, there was a tunnel where they made a bar and actually had a little studio, almost like where you could perform live acts and stuff, and they would show like blue movies down there. And he said, I know the names of the prominent Bakersfield families were in there, but many of them are still alive today, and I'm not going to tell you who they are.
Some things remain underground, apparently.
That's right. But yeah, it's been a fun thing to do, and I would love to. I know so many other cities have made them tourist attractions, as you said at the beginning of the show. I'm not sure. You think about all the individual property owners and the city get involved, it would be an enormous project, so that's probably not feasible. But the memories live on.
Yes, indeed. Again, we're talking with Richard Bean. He is the president and CEO of the Bakersfield Californian. He has been writing about the Bakersfield tunnels, long-forgotten subterranean passageways connecting basements and buildings in downtown Bakersfield and in the Chinatown era. You can read his column in the Bakersfield Californian and also find it online at bakersfieldobserved.com. Richard Bean, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Joe.
Well, that's all for today's Valley Edition. Have a comment about today's show? You can tweet us at KVPR or send us an email. The address is talk@KVPR. For Valley Edition producer Ezra David Romero, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org.